On Friday, the 21st of April last, President Kennedy, speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors about the situation in Cuba, made this observation. On that unhappy island, as in many other places in the contest for freedom, the news has been getting worse instead of better. President Kennedy's admission was candid and unfortunately correct. The poet once observed that April is the cruelest month. For the United States, April 1961 was possibly the most galling and certainly the most frustrating of the past decade. Item, Cochinas Bay. A foredoomed band of Cuban rebels, chaperoned and nursemaided by agents of our government, attempted a badly organized, sadly intelligenced invasion of that island, and succeeded only in making Dr. Castro more secure in the saddle than he had been before. And like Nasser after Suez, Castro's stature grew, did not diminish. And like Great Britain and France's stature after Suez, American prestige fell also. We were highly compromised and publicly shamed by this display of petulance and ineptitude. Item, Laos. For 8 years, the United States has entirely equipped, trained, and financed the Royal Laotian Army. It is the most highly paid army in all of Asia. In 2 months, this past spring, this army proved that it had mastered only one chapter in the military textbook, a chapter which deals with tactical retreat before an inferior enemy. In 2 months, half of Laos fell into Pathet Lao rebel hands, and this small but strategic country will soon be again placed under a neutralist government, now leaning more radically to the left than ever before, the government of Suvanafuma, a government which we conspired slightly over a year ago to force out of power. Again, America stood with prestige radically lowered, highly compromised, and publicly shamed. Item, barricades across Parisian boulevards. The gendarmerie and the Home Guard of France called out against the possibility of an invasion by paratroops of the rebel Algerian generals. Fortunately, the energy and the determination and vigor of General de Gaulle put down this rebellion without bloodshed. But in April, it became evident that France would be for many years a nation divided against herself. We faced in April of 1961 the realization that Germany stood again as the Colossus of Europe. Germany soon to be armed with NATO atomic weapons, Germany dreaming of reunification, a Germany which has not yet proven to the world that the seeds of Nazism have been uprooted and are no longer present. The cockpit of the Third World War may yet be the plains of Central Europe, as has been the cockpit of each previous major war of the past century. There is now no counterbalancing force in the West to hold German ambition in check. Item, the thundering triumph of Uri Gagarin in Red Square. This was a triumph not only of the Russians, but of all humanity. Gagarin is the Lindbergh of outer space. He projected man into the space age. And the world applauded this dramatic scientific advance, but our applause was half-hearted. Not only did we think back of our frustrated, lagging efforts in the space race, but we had the gnawing sensation in the back of our minds that somehow America was being passed by, not only in engineering, not only in technology, but also in progress, in politics, and all that makes for advance and for strength in the modern world. How did Americans take the frustrations of this cruel month of April? Many were outraged and indignant and ireful, and many called for direct action. They could not imagine that the world would not dance to the American tune. We will send in our soldiers, our might, and we will prove that Cuba can be captured and Laos can be kept from the Chinese-Russian orbit. Remember 2-3 weeks ago, the National Security Council was meeting daily, considering the deployment, the active military deployment of our troops in 3 major areas of the world, Laos, and Cuba, and in Algeria. During those dramatic, hard-to-bear, and bitter days, I took occasion, as did many other Americans, to write my views to the President. And I said in my letter, like all fellow Americans, I have been profoundly disturbed by the recent events in Cuba. I join my assurance to those already widely given that when a decision is reached, you will lead a nation united. I venture to express to you the hope that our future policy will continue our traditional American respect for international law and our reliance upon peaceful settlements. Cuba has bloodied our nose, but a bloody nose is far less damaging than a bloody war. We do not approve of Dr. Castro's rule, his revolution, which all of us at first welcomed because of the freedom and social reforms which it promised, has gone sour. Not only have American interests suffered, Castro has shown a contempt for human rights which is characteristic of all dictators. I question, however, the rationale of any direct intervention. The assistance which we gave to the refugees in their attempted invasion has seriously backfired. To be sure, we can easily conquer Cuba by our military might, but can we permanently pacify it with our arms? Or forcibly bring it into our orbit? In recent statements, Mr. President, you have spoken of the threat to our national security which is posed by the shipment of Russian arms into Cuba. But we too have built bases in Turkey, Iran, and West Germany, whose proximity to Russian centers approximates that of Cuba to our own mainland. The action of the Soviets is certainly provocative and reprehensible. But are our own hands clean? Is it possible, Mr. President, hermetically to seal off the Western Hemisphere with a thus far shalt thou go and no farther policy? Communism is a virus which floats invisibly in and into the body politic of all deprived and aggrieved peoples. It may be possible to immunize against this virus, but you cannot certainly destroy it with armies. Your proposed economic aid to the Americas is the most promising antitoxin yet developed. But here, too, we must bear in mind that not all groups will voluntarily roll up their sleeves for the needle, and with some the serum may not take. This should not discourage us or drive us to direct action. If truth and right are on our side, we can well afford to bide our time and carry on in patience and confidence, our humane and democratic mission in the world. The peoples of the Western Hemisphere are no different from peoples elsewhere. They have their particular peeves, hates, passions, weaknesses, and loyalties, not necessarily identical with our own. In fact, the Western Hemisphere nations have never presented a solid front to foreign ideologies. I recall the large pockets of pro-Nazi sentiment which existed in some countries of Latin America during the last World War. We shall have to compete for years to come in Latin America as elsewhere for the hearts of men. Reason often fails to move peoples whose hurt is ancient. Bayonets fail, for they prod the flesh, not the heart. We cannot arbitrarily interfere wherever and whenever unfriendly governments come to power. Such interference will not add to our security. It will cost us prestige and the sacrifice of our principles, and it will drive these governments further east. I am particularly concerned with the present dangers to our democratic traditions which are implicit in the Cuban imbroglio. The American public is not at fault, for it was never consulted. We have always been caught short whenever policymakers acted independently of the nation's will. Passions are running high today, and the incitement and temptation to act vigorously and immediately, to put an end to it all, to safeguard democracy for all future time, is great. I venture to suggest, Mr. President, that this is your historic opportunity to outride the storm and to remind our people of the words of the ancient prophet, "In quietness and confidence shall be your strength." This is a year when the minds of all Americans turn to Abraham Lincoln. If he were to speak to the man who now occupies his place in the White House, I believe he would say to him, "Your burdens are many and difficult, as were mine. Mine were domestic problems which led to war. Yours are worldwide problems which must not lead to war. I could not always see clearly for the mist and the fog which surrounded me, nor will you. But have faith in the people whom you have been called to lead, and in the ideals upon which your country is founded. Be firm and inflexible on principle, but open-minded, receptive, and prudent on policy. Lead in courage and in faith, and with malice towards none and with charity for all, help to draw all nations closer together in brotherhood and peace." Well, the danger that anger would precipitate us into military involvement seems to have passed. Dean Rusk has announced that we do not contemplate now any direct military intervention in Cuba. The president himself has all but ruled out military intervention in Laos on the grounds that here is a people not prepared itself to struggle and fight for freedom. What were the rest of our rainbow of reaction towards frustration and cruelty, defeat? Many Americans began to say, as they had said once before in the 1930s, that democracy cannot compete with dictatorship, that our way of government is too slow and our people too flabby and our liberties too circumscribing of government decision. That we are always behindhand in tactic. Na seka goyim, let us be like the Russians. Let us centralize power in the hands of a few bureaus, in the hands of a few men. Let us give our military broader powers than it now has. Let us attempt what is being called paramilitary adventuring. Subversion. The establishment of puppet governments. Cloak and dagger activity of all kinds. Let us beat the Russians at their own game by becoming more Russian than the Russian. Now, Hitler, of course, lies in his well-deserved hell. But America was victorious. And democracy was able to sustain itself, though Hitler's military machine was apparently more competent, more able of immediate decision than our own. But I wonder if the premise of this whole issue being raised so widely in our land is not misunderstood and misconstrued. Was the indecision of the American people really at heart at fault? Were we too concerned with our homes and our routine in our suburbs? Did we refuse the government anything that had been asked of us? Were we at fault? In Laos? The American people have never refused to vote a single dollar of aid for Laos requested by any department of the federal government. For over 8 years, we have poured more of our tax monies into Laos proportionately than into any other nation of the globe. Are we at fault that this aid has been surrounded by scandal? That it has made for inflation and the impoverishment of peoples instead of for friendship and the increase of the and progress and prosperity of the Lao? In 1956 and 57, reports began to filter back to the United States through our press. But our aid to Laos was going into the wrong hands. It had been designed to build hospitals and schools and roads and dams and irrigation systems, and it was building an army and millions of dollars of profits for the feudal nobles who control the land. And the American people, exercising their democratic prerogative, demanded of the Congress an investigation of the aid to Laos. Not because they begrudged the dollar, but because they begrudged the loss of face and the loss of prestige that this aid was winning for them or losing for them. And in 1957 and 1958, the House Committee on Government Organization investigated the aid to Laos, and the report that it made was a blistering one, concluding with these words. In summary, the decision to support a 25,000-man army motivated by a Department of State desire to provide political stability, seems to have been the foundation for a series of developments which detract from that stability. The aid program in Laos has not prevented the spread of communism in Laos. In fact, the communist victory in the last year's elections, based on the slogans of government corruption and government indifference, lead one to conclude that the United States aid program had contributed to an atmosphere in which the ordinary people of Laos question the value of friendship to the United States. The ordinary man of Laos, the man who picked up the gun dropped by the Russian and fought for the Pathet Lao, he saw his few savings blown away by a rampant inflation. He saw American treasure pour into his country and give Cadillacs to his hated nobles, and build an army which he has over the centuries learned to mistrust because it lives on the plunder of his field. Is it any wonder that he listened to the whispers that come through the jungle of another kind of government, which speaks of masses and of the needs of people, of roofs over people's heads, of medicine for people's aches, of a school teacher for the country village or a people's children? The American people in democratic discussion were determined that our whole aid program to Laos be revised. It had been designed to help the people and obviously was going only towards mercenary pay. Was democracy at fault? Because the government of the United States or bureaus of the government refused to revise that policy? Because they continue to plow in millions and billions, totaling almost half a billion of dollars of aid into this country for purely military purposes? Were they at fault that this continued aid gave substance to the claims of the guerrilla bands in the northern fastness who were rebelling? Was democracy at fault because an intelligence agency in our own State Department in Laos conspired in April of last year fraudulently to aid and abet an election which turned out not only every leftist minister in the government, but every neutralist minister and the neutralist premier himself, Suvanafuma, and returned a national assembly purged of all delegates except those of the extreme right-wing minority? Is democracy at fault or bureaucracy? Public indecision or governmental decision? Is democracy at fault that governments of the agencies of the United States government determined when a counter-revolution had pushed this minority government aside and reestablished Suvarnabhumi to equip, to train, to transport the small right-wing group back to the capital, to give them the guns with which to push out the neutralist government, and to wed the allegiance of left and center, which has now caused us not only to lose the friendship, but lose the geography, lose the interest, lose all the money that we have poured in a vain attempt to succor this country, so strategic in Southeast Asia. Who is at fault? The government or the people? Are the people at fault for the fact that Gagarin traveled at 17,000 miles per hour around the globe and Mr. Shepard, Commander Shepard, traveled only to the Great Bahamas? Has the American public ever refused to vote a single dollar requested by our Defense Department and national agencies for missile research or space development? We have not. The government has asked and we have voted. Indeed, it is the public who in the past 3 years has been pressuring the government to centralize all of its missile research and activity. And it is the non-democratic elements in our government, the Pentagon and the military, which persists for reasons known only to themselves to war among themselves for their petty princeling prerogatives, and to resist the mandate of the people and of the Congress and of the President to merge the armed forces into one centralized and efficient unit. The people have demanded this for 12 years, and it is not yet a reality. Is democracy at fault? Is democracy at fault in Cuba? Was the democratic will consulted before Central Intelligence Agencies began to equip and to train and to mobilize the Cuban refugee? Were we at fault because this group was badly intelligenced and given bad advice? We were not. Indeed, throughout this, it appears to me that the general public has manifested a higher order of wisdom than was being manifest in the nation's capital. Is the press at fault? President Kennedy seemed to suggest this in the heat of the first defeat. He seemed to suggest that the press, by printing stories of the mobilization of the Cuban refugee, was somehow guilty of having revealed state secrets to the nation. Can anyone really believe that what was known to every sun worshiper who visited Miami was not known to the intelligence agents of Castro's government? Ought not the federal government have recognized that if this story was so broadly known, there was not a chance of success for this mission? Was Commander Shepard's flight into space any less successful because it was done under the glare of the television camera? Is there any causal relationship between the many failures of our various missiles and the way these have been reported in the paper? Indeed, has not this reporting of our failures led to a public demand for greater energy and greater centralization of authority and greater funds being spent on this all-important area of government activity? And is it not the reports of the scandal in Laos which precipitated the demand for a revision of our foreign aid, a revision which was not undertaken, but yet which might have done wonders for American prestige and for American policy? No, I cannot believe that the American people are at fault, nor is democracy at fault, our system of liberties. It may work slowly, but when the public is informed, it has never in the whole history of the United States failed to exercise the prudence and the principle and the sacrifice demanded of it. Nor is our free press at fault. Indeed, if anything, it has given us the warning which, if heeded, would have saved us from the cruelties of April. Where then shall the fault be placed? President Eisenhower Monday last suggested that this was not the time for witch hunting, for raking over old coals. And if he meant that we ought not to try and pinpoint the guilt on any one official's shoulders, he is right. We seek no scapegoat, but we do need to understand the reason for these persisting failures. Their reason, their philosophy, lies in a mood which has permeated Washington for a decade or more. A mood which persists in reducing all the complicated arithmetic of international politics to a single equation of the Cold War. You're for us, you're against us. You're pro-American, if so, we can accept the most reprehensible government. You're anti-American, if so, we are opposed to the most necessary social reform. Laos is a small country, twice the size of the state of Ohio, with one-tenth of our population. 95% of the Laotians are illiterate. 90% of the Lao probably do not know that they belong to any officially organized country. There are in Laos ancient clan hatreds between Ka and Lao and Vietnamese. Laos is a feudal country with intermarried feudal overlords who squabble among themselves for the spoils and the taxation of the people. Laos has little communication between its villages, and its villagers speak 20 separate dialects. And yet we reduce the complicated political structure of Laos to a right-wing, conservative, feudal wing which is for us, to a large centralist group which we misprize because it cannot make up its mind, and to a small left-wing communist group whom we rightly misprize because they are drawing arms and support from the communists. Is Laos ready to make up its mind? Obviously, it is involved in the struggle between East and West. But to the average Laotian, the struggle is between want and need, between today's poverty and the hope of tomorrow's progress. The average Laotian is impatient as he sees wealth around him, treasure pouring into his nation. He looks on the Laotian political situation in terms of his pocketbook and his home and his poverty and his illiteracy and his hopes for his children. And we look on it in terms of the strategy of the Cold War. Our foreign aid in Laos was mercenaries' pay, and it failed because it was just that. Dr. Castro has perverted the July 29th revolution in Cuba. He has taken the bloom off the rose of what might have been a great revolution of social progress. We do not stand guilty of all of his acts, certainly. But did not our persistent arming, aiding, and applauding of Batista, despite his ruthlessness, his dictatorial police force, his thought control, did not this contribute to the extent of the explosion which came with the revolution? To every action, there is a reaction. The more suppression, the more potent the revolutionary explosion when it inevitably comes. And what is true of Cuba is true elsewhere in our globe. We saw it with Syngman Rhee in Korea, where so many of our boys died. For 10 years, we supported Mr. Rhee, supported him despite scandal and nepotism and dictatorial method, despite elections which were rigged. When the inevitable revolution came about and students and populace were snake dancing through the streets of Seoul, is it any wonder that they shouted in addition with "Down with Syngman Rhee, Yankee, go home"? No government has been more favorable to us than that of the Turkish government. We have important military bases in Turkey. In the past years, Adnan Menderes has become increasingly brutal, increasingly callous towards the constitutional rights guaranteed by the Turkish Bill of Rights. He has tried to establish himself as the dictator of Turkey. Was an American voice ever raised in protest, or did we simply continue to shovel in our treasure to this pro-Western government? And when this government last year was overthrown, Is it any wonder that the students and the populace, as they snake dance through the streets of Constantinople and Ankara, shouted anti-American slogans as well as slogans of Menderes to the gallows? And what is true in Laos and true in Cuba and true in Turkey and true in Korea can be true and will probably inevitably be true in the Dominican Republic, in Nicaragua, in Paraguay, in Ethiopia, in South Vietnam, in other nations of the world where there are forces in power attempting to suppress the inevitable emergence of the people, which is the hallmark of the 20th century. Governments whom we support because they are anti-communist, and by our support identify ourselves, whether we wish it or not, with the foes of progress and the foes of justice and the foes of the 20th century. And there is no easy solution to these complicated international problems. American policy has not been wholly selfish, though it has had a definite military fixation. Often we have been involved, and we will be involved, in these domestic internal disputes despite our best efforts to extricate ourselves from them. But we must recognize the dramatic, complicated, emerging, challenging equation of life in this century. We must realize that we cannot be happy bedfellows with those who would return their country or their people to a feudal type of rule. Indeed, America, by its history, by its context, by its own pride, should long since have divorced itself from such people. We cannot put away into the deep freeze until we solve the problems of the Cold War all of the complicated hopes, aspirations, and visions, and fumblings, and revolutions which will inevitably crop up about the world. We must see the world as it is, not as two camps lined up, one for freedom and one against, but as a group of nations, each individually working towards its own destiny, each filled with men and movements who are neither wholly good nor wholly evil, each implicated in ancient rivalries and complicated by ancient prejudices, each determined to fulfill its destiny before it is prepared to fulfill the destiny of the United States or of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. There is no reason in the world, given our history and given our principles, that we should give over by default to the Soviet all of the emerging movements and nations. Indeed, they are closer to us in spirit than they are to the dictatorial and repressive government represented by the Soviet. But we cannot buy them with mercenaries' pay. We cannot use them willy-nilly for our own strategic purposes and hope to buy thereby their friendship. We cannot conspire with their political leaders to restrain progress, to maintain and sustain vested interest, and hope thereby to win the allegiance of the masses and the allegiance of the brave spirits, sometimes misguided, however, who rise to lead these masses. President Kennedy knows this. He has said it. He said it in his inaugural address to the nation. He said it again in bold image in his first State of the Union message to Congress. To meet this array of challenges, to fulfill the role we cannot avoid on the world scene, we must re-examine and revise our whole arsenal of tools. One must not overshadow the other. On the presidential coat of arms, the American eagle holds in his right talon the olive branch, while in his left, he holds a bundle of arrows. We intend to give equal attention to both. First, we must strengthen our military tools. We are moving into a period of uncertain risk and great commitments, in which both the military and diplomatic possibilities require a free world force so powerful as to make any aggression clearly futile. Yet in the past, lack of a consistent, coherent military strategy, the absence of basic assumptions about our national requirements, and the faulty estimate and duplication arising from inter-service rivalries have made it difficult to assess accurately how adequate or inadequate our defenses really are. Secondly, we must improve our economic tools. Our role is essential and unavoidable in the construction of a sound and expanding economy for the entire non-communist world. Helping other nations build the strength to meet their own problems, to satisfy their own aspirations, to surmount their own dangers. The problems in achieving this goal are towering and unprecedented. The response must be towering and unprecedented as well, much as Lend-Lease and the Marshall Plan were in earlier years, which brought such fruitful results. The problems facing Mr. Kennedy are towering and they are unprecedented. Politics abhors simplicity. Politics is the government of peoples, and every person is a complicated individual. Our politics have failed when they were overly simple, when they were a choosing up sides politics. You're for me or you're against me. The world is neither for us or for the Russians or for any other nation, nor at this point against us or against the Russians or against any other nation. They are for themselves first and foremost. And we must give them the time to overcome their deprivation, to establish their economies, to emerge out of the blackness of colonial rule, to emerge out of the grayness of poverty and misery, for we challenge them with the dramatic, wonderful constitutional ideas which are at the core of the American dream. We must give them time, and we must give them help. And we must avoid the suspicion in all of our activities that we are using them as pawns in a complicated Cold War game of political chess. We read this morning in the sayings of the fathers an apt observation. The sword, the rabbis said, comes into the world because of justice being delayed, because of justice being perverted, because of those who render false decisions. Justice has been delayed in many parts of our globe, not always of our own causing. Justice is being perverted in many parts of our globe, and we are not always capable of righting the injustice. But we can make the right decisions only if we realize that our decisions must be based on justice, on what is right not only for us but for all peoples, on what is needed not only for our own selfish purposes but for their own selfish purposes. Only if we recognize that we are one of a family of nations, one of the most powerful of nations to be sure, but not the manager of a puppet opera, who by his strings and dexterous hands causes all the other nations of the world to dance on his stage attendance according to his words and his command. The world will follow its own course. We must follow our own. Let us follow it in pride. Let us follow it in principle. Let us follow it in justice and in confidence. Amen.